Talking today with Kembrew McLeod, and Kembrew was just after giving a seminar about the diminishing public domain in just about every field. So we're talking here about medicine, education, genetics, computing, just about everything. But who's driving this diminution?
Well, in the past 30 years, most major economies, the countries and the businesses behind them, have realized that intellectual properties are the things that are driving the economies. Increasingly in this post-industrial world, this is true. And so over the past 30 years, during this exact time, you see the increasing restrictions surrounding intellectual properties and the way in which we can use them. And furthermore, you see the diminishing of the public domain with the extension of copyright protection, not just in the U.S., but throughout the world. So in most of the world, the intellectual properties, or that is copyrights, are protected for the entire life of the author plus 70 years, which is an extraordinary amount of time.
Is this happening at the same time that the World Trade Organization is looking for liberalization in agriculture and in industry? Also in the service sector, you're saying as well, this is what's the main driving... any particular companies at the forefront, Bertelsmann or anybody like that?
Well, there are plenty of companies that are driving this push through the WTO for developing countries to adopt Western intellectual property laws. I would say I wouldn't pick out any single company. I think it would be uniform across industries, whether we're talking about pharmaceutical industries or publishing industries or other kinds of cultural industries. And the sad thing is that the same sorts of intellectual property laws that we're pushing on developing countries, when... and by we, I'm actually coming from the United States perspective. I'm a U.S. citizen. We, the United States, we were a developing country in the 19th century and the 18th century. And we heavily benefited from essentially piggybacking off what we would now call pirated materials. We didn't recognize the copyrights of other nations during this time in the 19th century, nor patent laws. So we were able to build our economy and grow and prosper because we were piggybacking off of the developments of other countries. And what we're essentially doing, we in the U.S. and in Western Europe, through the World Trade Organization, is attempting to stop that same kind of development that other developing countries today would be engaging in. The same sorts of behaviors that developing countries are engaging in which they're, you know, quote-unquote pirating the West's materials, is the exact same sort of behavior that the West was engaging in to build itself into a developed economy.
This is paralleled by subsidies. For instance, the U.S. economy was also built on subsidies, and now they want developing countries to get rid of their subsidies because they're in such a probably such a big player in markets generally. But I was going to ask you, you give the example of the socialist Woody Guthrie. Your land is my land.
Yes, Woody Guthrie wrote a song called This Land Is Your Land, and the chorus goes, this land is your land, this land is my land. And it's a celebration of communal property. And the sad thing is that because of these copyright extensions, this song is still private property, and it is enforced as private property by the publishers that control the Woody Guthrie songs.
So apart from the software, there's even issues of speech here. So you managed to get a certain expression patented. Tell us what that was.
Right. About 15 years ago, I had the idea to, in the United States, see if I could trademark the phrase freedom of expression. The impulse behind trying to trademark freedom of expression was I basically wanted the U.S. government to tell me what I hoped wasn't true. And the thing that I hoped wasn't true is that we're now in this day and age when even a phrase like freedom of expression can become private property through these intellectual property laws. And sadly, I was wrong. The U.S. government granted me control over the phrase freedom of expression, and it was a sort of prank, a little joke, but it's more like black humor. It's a darkly humorous joke.
This is the social impetus behind it. There's an atomization, which means that people are less able to see or to do anything about what's going on, but there's also the control aspect that corporations and institutions that are far larger than any one person as well are having increasing control over our norms and behaviours and over how things can be used, which are very much a part of us, whether it's our language or our genes.
Yes, and that's why we shouldn't be thinking about this in microscopic terms, such as those who are concerned about the end of the public domain and the realm of book publishing, people who are heavily invested in being able to reproduce books that are in the public domain, or those of us who are concerned about drug patents and gene patents. We shouldn't be sticking to our own individual corners, and rather what I hope to do and what others hope to do by articulating the connections between, let's say, the privatization of the public domain in the realm of folk music making, you know, the fact that Woody Guthrie's song is still private property, and connecting that to the privatization of the genetic public domain, the fact that, you know, there are certain drugs that can't be developed because it involves contacting and getting permission from far too many different gene owners. And so these have global implications, and also, furthermore, we should be very concerned about the way in which, through the liberalization of economies that the WTO is trying to push, the way that has negative impacts on developing countries, so that countries that are now developing can't go through the same process that we in the United States went through, in which we were piggybacking off of the knowledge, the information generated by other countries.
We actually pay for something twice. And you give one example, I was asking to cite, but at the moment we have a public service broadcasting company, for instance, called RTE, which is state-funded. And people are paid to do their work, and then they sell it back to us, again on CD and DVD, because they could pay for it twice. But you have another example of such a thing happening.
Yeah, well, just in kind of the marginalized realm of academia, we have a situation where a professor like myself, I'm supported by state funding, and I'm paid to produce knowledge, to produce scholarship, and what ends up happening is, in order for me and others to participate in this so-called academic game, in order to, well, be tenured and to be promoted, we have to essentially give up our copyrights and sell them to journals. What happens, academic journals, and what happens with that is that our libraries at the University of Iowa, for instance, where I work and live, have to end up buying back those copyrights. That is, they have to pay for access to those copyrights. So they're essentially paying twice. The state is paying twice for me to produce knowledge. And it restricts the way in which knowledge can be spread, especially to those who don't have access to, you know, the university library.
Everybody pays for them academic journals, but only people who have access to the library can get their hands on it. But also, the fact that the library has to pay for this stuff is ridiculous, since the state has produced it in the first place.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a movement amongst librarians in the United States and elsewhere, and it's called the Open Access Journal Movement, in which they're encouraging scholars, particularly those who have a little more power and who are tenured, to begin publishing in so-called open access journals, which are still peer-reviewed, legitimate scholarly journals, but which do not have the same sorts of restrictions to access that the journals that are owned, for instance, by Blackwell or Taylor and Francis and others have that impose upon. Yes.
This raises a very interesting question about the idea of trying to create our own positive space of knowledge. That's copyleft, or another word for that is Creative Commons, which is a sort of a different type of term. For instance, Google tried to make everything available, every academic text available online. And academics oppose it. But in fact, is this copyright measuring actually going to bury academia? Because people will actually try to rejig stuff and source it free, rather than going to the original source, which they have to pay for.
Yeah, that is a concern, because, I mean, there are certainly good things about academia. The fact that there are, for instance, peer review processes. Sometimes that can be a bad thing. But the most important thing about academia is that we should be able to engage in a free flow of information without concern about what the ramifications are, you know, without concern about having to change content. You know, we should be more concerned with saying what we want to say, printing what we want to say, and then also reprinting what we want to say, quoting who we want to quote, etc.
There's a case also that there's a privatization of universities going on as well, with business departments taking over, and each department and faculty having to, quote, pay its way. And this is also affecting what people are learning, and it's really dumbing down, isn't it?
Yes, so then one of the sad things about privatization and this neoliberalist agenda that is connected to intellectual property laws in the way that now we have all sorts of new intellectual properties like genes that can now be privately owned. Well, the cousin of that is the way in which this neoliberalist agenda is basically creating a system in which anything that isn't considered valuable, economically, should be discarded. And so what that means in terms of getting back to the issues of copyright is that you have all these books that are out of print that cannot be accessed because the publisher doesn't think it's valuable enough to reprint, but there are millions of books actually that do not go into the public domain each year because of the extension of copyright laws. And these millions of books will never get reprinted just because it's very hard to track down the copyright owner. And so, getting back to the neoliberalist agenda, things that aren't considered valuable are things that will never legitimately be reprinted. So we actually have to resort to out-and-out piracy if we want to circulate certain texts.
And the problem with piracy is it's more difficult to regulate it. So again, it's a death knell for academia because people will source things online. And that's because it's cheaper to actually do that. Maybe it's a good thing. Maybe actually in getting rid of the hierarchy in academia, it will be more postmodernist in the Millesian sense that it'll make things more simpler and it'll actually lead to a better dialogue.
Well, that's a really good point. I mean, I'm all for demolishing hierarchies, but rather than like the demolishing of hierarchies because, you know, intellectual property laws have created a situation which academic works can't be accessed by common people. People who pay taxes or people who have every right to absorb the same knowledge that so-called scholars do. That still, to me, is a sad situation. What I would rather see is a situation in which traditional academia thrives and adapts, and that rather than that being pushed to the wayside, it's just one more, and also this is, I guess, is a postmodern idea, one more amongst a variety of other issues, writings, publishing venues that people can access. So I'm saying that people should still, everyday people should still be able to access academic ideas and words, paragraphs, sentences, journal articles, and books. But it's nice to know that there are other options as well.
Well, maybe true universal academia will actually become a culture rather than an official institution. Which should be something quite nice about that as well, isn't there?
I wholeheartedly agree.
Okay, I just want to say, back to genetics, because and we're nearly finished now, but just on genetics, you can see a situation where, I don't know if you know about these chimeras, where you can put, for instance, mixed human and mice genes, or human and rat genes, or human and monkey genes, which is already going on. And you can get something, in theory, half monkey, half human, and that will be patented, and people will own. And probably very soon, well, within a few hundred years, you can see a situation where people actually own, by law, if we survive the environmental catastrophe, whatever is coming along, you know. You can actually see a situation where humans can be owned, legally, by other humans, by virtue of a slight genetic difference.
Well, and I mean, I think there are many issues that come into this question. I mean, questions that animal rights activists have been talking about, and questions that they've been asking for years, as well as religious philosophers, ethicists, about, yeah, what is going to happen when you have a situation in which life can be owned. So in 1980, it was a situation in which we could own bacteria, but it's now grown to mammals, even. Mammals can be patented. So where does that stop? And that has very, very serious and disturbing implications for the way in which we interact as social beings.
And already we see it in the drugs industry, for instance, who owns the retroviral agents that help combat AIDS, for instance, and how they can be patented. And so, and even dependent drugs, that drugs companies can keep people dependent for years unnecessarily. And that's, even that is owned. It's not contrived, though, is it?
No, it's definitely a business plan. it's a business plan.
Okay, you are reducing it to a few individuals at this stage.
Well, I mean, it also is a larger cultural and economic logic, that logic of capitalism. But, you know, if you want to reduce it to individuals and institutions, it's a great business plan.
Sadly, the 80% are led by the few.
Yes, yes. Thank you.
Well, apart from that, let's talk about just finally, this is the final thing, about solutions. What are the solutions as far as you're concerned? What can people do practically?
Well, I think one thing that can happen is for more people to embrace these smaller solutions, because we can't get to a larger solution until we start figuring out how smaller solutions work and how they do not work. And I think the ones that are working now are, for instance, I mentioned the open access movement, the open access journal movement, which will make academic ideas available not only to university libraries that don't have to worry about buying back twice knowledge, but also everyday people who want to access it, who want to have access to, you know, what is now a hierarchized stream of information. And secondly, there's an organization that some indie media listeners probably know about, which is Creative Commons, which is an organization that makes it very simple for those of us who are knowledge producers, cultural producers, scientists, whatever, to create an easy contract that will tell readers, listeners, whomever, what they can and can't do with the stuff that you create. And so it's basically, you know, it's a legal contractual system that echoes something that we learned, like, early on in school that, you know, it's important to share, but we still can retain control and make decisions about how someone can use our work. And then they're just quite simply, you know, engaging in the kinds of anti-globalization struggles that and coalitions that are concerned with the ways in which intellectual property laws are imposed on developing countries to their detriment to keep them in economic servitude to the West. And so, I don't know, two like low-level, very specific solutions, open access journal movement, secondly, Creative Commons, and lastly, you know, grassroots organizing around the effects of globalization.
We live in interesting times.
Yes, we do. And I really appreciate your time. Thanks for listening. And thanks for talking to me.